Gildan Audio presents Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning by Viktor E. Frankl. Read by Grover Gardner.
Dedication to my sister. Forward. On January 1st, 1994, I stood at the top of the stairs at the embassy residence, a bit confused. The diminutive, white-haired man walking spryly toward me wasn't at all what I'd expected. I shook the hand of Viktor Frankl, my guest, and told him, "I read your book 25 years ago, and I still remember it." "Do you remember it in your mind or in your heart?" he asked. "In my heart." "That's good," he answered, as if bestowing a blessing. Throughout the coming months, I came to rely on Professor Frankl as a confidant and an advisor. Whether the subject was U.S. foreign policy in Bosnia, family health problems, or my own personal and professional priorities, Viktor and Ellie were my anchor, a vital source of wisdom. And when wisdom failed us all, they were my wellspring of comfort. Their clarity was imparted with kindness, understanding, and love. I was close enough to know some of their own travails, and I wondered about their own source of strength. This book holds an answer to that question, for in it we see Viktor Frankl dealing with the finitude of his place within infinite possibility. He does not confuse his own limitations with ultimate limitation, nor does he mistake his own being with ultimate being. There is also an extraordinary sense of tolerance in his thinking, a graciousness in his concession that our symbols for ultimate meaning only point to a reality we cannot experience directly. The concentration camps in which he suffered and in which his loved ones died were, after all, created to annihilate those who were different, and so Frankl leaves room for the breadth of human experience of the metaphysical. Let God take on an anthropomorphic form for some. For others, let God be confused with the self. After all, ultimate meaning is certainly able to absorb the finitude of our attempts to understand and describe infinity. But for Frankl, such tolerance does not imply a lack of judgment. For there is evil in the world, and his life bears the scars. The unconscious search for ultimate meaning can lead to nefarious ends: flagrant nationalism, obsessive jealousies, ethnic hate, compulsive work. Half a century since this volume was conceived, I spent an afternoon with Ellie and Viktor speaking not only of Auschwitz, but also of Srebrenica, a diabolic and perverted meaning found by some in sadistic debauchery. So we are reminded once again that abstract theory is not an end in itself. It must shape concrete living. From this small volume, there is a great moral imperative to be pondered. As we reflect on Frankl's thought, we may take time to muse on what we personally hold most dear, and, even in the moment of that intimate dialogue, contribute to the universal force for goodness. Tolerance, jealousy, benevolence, hate, decency. What will be ultimate in our lives? As Viktor Frankl would remind us, the choice is ours. Swanee Hunt, United States Ambassador to Austria. Preface. The main title of this book is identical with the title of the Oscar Pfister Award lecture that I gave at the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association in 1985. The text of this lecture is reprinted here as Chapter 9. As for the first part of this volume, it has already been published under the title The Unconscious God in 1975, the English translation of Der Unbewusste Gott, published in 1947. This book, in turn, had been based on the manuscript for a presentation I had been invited to give in Vienna only a few months after the end of the war. The printing history of the present volume thus goes back some 50 years. Perusing what I wrote in 1947, in 1975, and in 1985, I feel that it is, as a whole, a consistent sequence of presentations of some substantial thoughts regarding a quite important subject. Hopefully, then, some of what I have written through these decades may be of value to some readers. However it may be, see, I have not kept my lips closed. Viktor Frankl. Preface to the first English edition. The material in this book is drawn from a lecture I gave shortly after World War II, at the invitation of a small club of Viennese intellectuals. My audience was composed of no more than a dozen listeners. In 1947, the lecture was published as a book in German. It is only now, 28 years after its original publication, that the book appears in an English translation. Spanish, Danish, Dutch, French, Greek, Hebrew, Italian, Japanese, Polish, Serbo-Croatian, and Swedish editions have already been published. Considering the time that has elapsed since the first edition, more than a quarter of a century, it might be understood that I no longer am in a position to subscribe fully to each and every word as it was printed in 1947. My thinking has developed considerably in the meantime, developed and, I hope, also matured. To be sure, some of the changes have been implemented in the present edition by slightly altering certain passages. However, I have deliberately refrained from major alterations of the text because, of my 20 books, this is the most organized and systematized one, and it would have been a pity to destroy the cohesive structure of this piece of work by interspersing too much of the material that might have accrued in the meantime. All the more, I welcome the alternative that the publishers Simon & Schuster offered me, namely, to add, by way of a postscript, a supplementary chapter outlining some of the ideas that have evolved in my theory of conscience during the last two decades. As to the wider field that this book concerns, i.e. the interrelationship between psychotherapy and theology, the reader will find pertinent discussions in my two most recent books, published in English, and in English only, Psychotherapy and Existentialism and The Will to Meaning. In each of these books, one chapter explicitly deals with religious issues, and there are scattered references to this topic as well. The updated bibliography at the end of this volume, not included in this recording, will enable the reader to locate further publications, not only those dealing with the relationship between religion and psychiatry, but also those covering the whole area of logotherapeutic teachings and practices. However, the main thesis propounded in the lecture entitled The Unconscious God remains still valid and tenable. There is, in fact, a religious sense deeply rooted in each and every man's unconscious depths. In two of my books, Man's Search for Meaning and the above-mentioned The Will to Meaning, evidence has been advanced to support my contention that this sense may break through unexpectedly, even in cases of severe mental illness, such as psychoses. For example, a student of mine at the United States International University, San Diego, California, wrote, "In the mental hospital, I was locked like an animal in a cage. No one came when I called begging to be taken to the bathroom, and I finally had to succumb to the inevitable. Blessedly, I was given daily shock treatment, insulin shock, and sufficient drugs so that I lost most of the next several weeks. But in the darkness, I had acquired a sense of my own unique mission in the world. I knew then, as I know now, that I must have been preserved for some reason. However small, it is something that only I can do, and it is vitally important that I do it. And because in the darkest moment of my life, when I lay abandoned as an animal in a cage, when because of the forgetfulness introduced by ECT, I could not call out to him, he was there. In the solitary darkness of the pit where men had abandoned me, he was there. When I did not know his name, he was there. God was there." Likewise, such unexpected religious feelings may break through under other circumstances, as was the case with a man who wrote from prison. "I am at the age of 54, financially ruined, in jail. At the beginning of this incarceration, 8 months ago, everything looked hopeless and irrevocably lost in chaos that I could never hope to understand, much less to solve. Endless months passed. Then one day I had a visit by a court psychiatrist, to whom I took an immense liking right from the start, as he introduced himself with a very pleasant smile and a handshake, like I would be still somebody, or at least a human being. Something deep and unexplainable happened to me from there on. I found myself reliving my life. That night, in the stillness of my small cell, I experienced a most unusual religious feeling which I never had before. I was able to pray, and with utmost sincerity, I accepted a higher will to which I have surrendered the pain and sorrow as meaningful and ultimate, not needing explanation. From here on, I have undergone a tremendous recovery." This happened in Baltimore County Prison in April of this year. Today I am at complete peace with myself and the world. I have found the true meaning of my life, and time can only delay its fulfillment, but not deter it. At 54, I have decided to reconstruct my life and to finish my schooling. I am sure I can accomplish my goal. I have also found a new great source of unexpected vitality. I am able now to laugh over my own miseries instead of wallowing in the pain of irrevocable failure, and somehow there are hardly any great tragedies left. But one may discuss religion, irrespective of whether it is unconscious or conscious, for the question confronting us is more basic and radical. First, we must ask ourselves whether this is a legitimate area for psychiatric exploration. Lately, I have come to draw the line of demarcation between religion and psychiatry ever more sharply. I have learned and taught that the difference between them is no more nor less than a difference between various dimensions. From the very analogy with dimensions, however, it should become clear that these realms are by no means mutually exclusive. A higher dimension, by definition, is a more inclusive one. The lower dimension is included in the higher one. It is subsumed in it and encompassed by it. Thus, biology is overarched by psychology, psychology by noology, and noology by theology. The noological dimension may rightly be defined as the dimension of uniquely human phenomena. Among them, there is one that I regard as the most representative of the human reality. I have circumscribed this phenomenon in terms of man's search for meaning. Now, if this is correct, one may also be justified in defining religion as man's search for ultimate meaning. It was Albert Einstein who once contended that to be religious is to have found an answer to the question, what is the meaning of life? If we subscribe to this statement, we may then define belief and faith as trust in ultimate meaning. Once we have conceived of religion in this way, that is, in the widest possible sense, there is no doubt that psychiatrists are entitled also to investigate this phenomenon, although only its human aspect is accessible to a psychological exploration. The concept of religion in its widest possible sense, as it is here espoused, certainly goes far beyond the narrow concepts of God promulgated by many representatives of denominational and institutional religion. They often depict, not to say denigrate, God as a being who is primarily concerned with being believed in by the greatest possible number of believers, and along the lines of a specific creed at that. Just believe, we are told, and everything will be okay. But alas, not only is this order based on a distortion of any sound concept of deity, but even more importantly, it is doomed to failure. Obviously, there are certain activities that simply cannot be commanded, demanded, or ordered. And as it happens, the triad faith, hope, and love belongs to this class of activities that elude an approach with, so to speak, command characteristics. Faith, hope, and love cannot be established by command simply because they cannot be established at will. I cannot will to believe. I cannot will to hope. I cannot will to love. And least of all, can I will to will. Upon closer investigation, it turns out that what underlies the attempt to establish faith, hope, love, and will by command is the manipulative approach. The attempt to bring these states about at will, however, is ultimately based on an inappropriate objectification and reification of these human phenomena. They are turned into mere things, into mere objects. However, since faith, hope, love, and will are so-called intentional acts or activities along the lines of the terminology coined by Edmund Husserl and Max Scheler, the founders of the school of phenomenology, these activities are directed to intentional reference, in other words, to objects of their own. To the extent that one makes intentional acts into objects, he loses sight of their objects. Nowhere, to my knowledge, is this brought home to us more strikingly than with the unique human phenomenon of laughter. You cannot order anyone to laugh. If you want him to laugh, you must tell him a joke. But isn't it, in a way, the same with religion? If you want people to have faith and belief in God, you cannot rely on preaching along the lines of a particular church, but must, in the first place, portray your God believably. And you must act credibly yourself. In other words, You have to do the very opposite of what so often is done by the representatives of organized religion when they build up an image of God as someone who is primarily interested in being believed in, and who rigorously insists that those who believe in him be affiliated with a particular church. Small wonder that such representatives of religion behave as though they saw the main task of their own denomination as that of overriding other denominations. Certainly the trend is away from religion, conceived in such a strictly denominational sense. Yet this is not to imply that eventually there will be a universal religion. On the contrary, if religion is to survive, it will have to be profoundly personalized. This does not mean that there is no need for symbols and rituals. Even the die-hard agnostic and atheist cannot completely dismiss symbols. Consider the Russians, who once constructed a monument to express symbolically their indebtedness and gratitude to the thousands of dogs that had been sacrificed by Pavlov in the course of his famous conditioned reflex experiments. What a purely symbolic gesture, pointless by the utilitarian yardstick adopted by dialectical materialism, and yet extremely meaningful to the heart of the Russian nation. A heart like that, as Blaise Pascal once observed, has reasons that are unknown to reason. Le cœur a ses raisons que la raison ne connaît point. The heart of man defies even Marxist indoctrination. To all appearances, religion is not dying, and insofar as this is true, God is not dead either, not even after Auschwitz, to quote the title of a book. For either belief in God is unconditional or it is not belief at all. If it is unconditional, it will stand and face the fact that 6 million died in the Nazi Holocaust. If it is not unconditional, it will fall away if only a single innocent child has to die, to resort to an argument once advanced by Dostoevsky. There is no point in bargaining with God, say by arguing, up to 6,000 or even 1 million victims of the Holocaust, I maintain my belief in thee, but from 1 million upward, nothing can be done any longer, and I am sorry, but I must renounce my belief in thee. The truth is that among those who actually went through the experience of Auschwitz, the number of those whose religious life was deepened, in spite of, not because of, this experience, by far exceeds the number of those who gave up their belief. To paraphrase what La Rochefoucauld once remarked with regard to love, one might say that just as the small fire is extinguished by the storm while a large fire is enhanced by it, likewise a weak faith is weakened by predicaments and catastrophes, whereas a strong faith is strengthened by them. Viktor E. Frankl. Acknowledgements. When I first conceived the idea to expand one of my personally favorite books, The Unconscious God, into Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning, I thought it to be a rather uncomplicated task, as in all things, experience turned out to be the best teacher. Bringing this book to fruition has been truly a team effort, and for that I am indebted to many. I am indebted to Joanna Lawrence of Plenum Publishing Company for making Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning a reality. I am also most grateful to the Honorable Swanee Hunt, the U.S. Ambassador to Austria, for honoring me by writing the foreword to this book. She has captured the true spirit of my work. I am also indebted to Dr. J. Levinson, my assistant and friend, for his help in coordinating the many logistical details of this project. I am deeply grateful to my son-in-law, Dr. Franz Vesely, who served as my personal editor-in-chief in Vienna, providing advice and help whenever it was needed. Without the diligent and gracious service of Franz and Jay, this book would never have become a reality. Last, but certainly not least, I wish to express my love and appreciation to my wife, Ellie. She is my light, my inspiration, my support. To them and to all the other unnamed contributors, I express my deepest appreciation. Ecce labia mea non cohibui. Chapter 1. The Essence of Existential Analysis. Arthur Schnitzler, Vienna's famous poet and a contemporary of Sigmund Freud, has been quoted as saying that there are really only three virtues: objectivity, courage, and sense of responsibility. It would be tempting to allot to each of these virtues one of the schools of psychotherapy that have emerged from Viennese soil. It is obvious that the virtue of courage fits Adlerian psychology. The Adlerian, after all, regards his entire therapeutic procedure and the final analysis as nothing but an attempt at encouraging the patient. The purpose of this encouragement is to help the patient overcome his inferiority feelings, which Adlerian psychology considers to be a decisive pathogenic factor. In the same way, another of the virtues mentioned fits Freudian psychoanalysis, that of objectivity. What else could it have been that enabled Sigmund Freud, like Oedipus, to look into the eyes of the Sphinx, the human psyche, and to draw out its riddle at the risk of a most dreadful discovery? In his time, such an undertaking was colossal, and so was his accomplishment. Up to then, psychology, particularly so-called academic psychology, had shunned everything that Freud then made the focus of his teaching, as the anatomist Julius Tandler jokingly called the somatology that was taught in Vienna's junior high schools anatomy with the exclusion of the genital. So Freud could have said that the academic psychology was psychology with the exclusion of the libidinal. However, psychoanalysis not only adopted objectivity, it succumbed to it. Objectivity eventually led to objectification or reification. That is, psychoanalysis made the human person into an object, the human being into a thing. Psychoanalysis regards the patient as ruled by mechanisms, and it conceives of the therapist as the one who knows the technique by which disturbed mechanisms may be repaired. But cynicism lurks behind an interpretation of psychotherapy in terms of mere technique. It is true that we can see the therapist as a technician only if we have first viewed the patient as some sort of machine. Only an homme machine, I would say, is in need of a médecin technicien. How is it that psychoanalysis arrived at this technically minded mechanistic view? It is understandable, considering the intellectual climate in which psychoanalysis emerged, but it must also be understood in the context of the social milieu of the time, a milieu full of prudery. The mechanistic view was a reactionary response to that prudery, and today it is out of date in many respects. But Freud not only reacted to his time, he also acted out of his time. When he formed his teaching, he did so completely under the influence of associationism, which was then beginning to dominate the field of psychology. Associationism, however, was the product of naturalism, an ideology typical of the late 19th century. Within Freud's teaching, naturalism makes itself most conspicuous in two basic characteristics of psychoanalysis: its psychological atomism and its theory of psychic energy. Psychoanalysis views the whole of the human psyche atomistically as pieced together out of separate parts, i.e., out of various drives, which in turn are composed of so-called drive components. Thus, the psyche is not only atomized but anatomized, i.e., the analysis of the psyche becomes its anatomy. In this way, the wholeness of the human person is destroyed. One could say, on the one hand, that psychoanalysis depersonalizes man. On the other hand, it personifies the individual aspects within the totality of the psyche, aspects that are often in conflict with one another. Sometimes they are not only personified but even demonized, e.g. when the id or the superego is dealt with as if it were a relatively independent pseudo-personal power in itself. Psychoanalysis destroys the unified whole of the human person and then has the task of reconstructing the whole person out of the pieces. This atomistic view is most evident in Freud's hypothesis that the ego is made up out of ego drives. According to this hypothesis, the censor, which represses the drives, is itself a drive. Just consider the following statement from Freud's Three Essays on the Theory of Sexuality. "The production of sexual excitation produces a store of energy which is employed to a great extent for purposes other than sexual, namely, through repression, in building up the subsequently developed barriers against sexuality." To me, this is comparable to claiming that a builder who has constructed a building out of bricks is himself built of bricks. For that which builds a barrier against sexuality cannot itself be made up of sexuality. What is obvious here is the materialism that permeates the psychoanalytic way of thinking and also ultimately accounts for its atomism. In addition to atomism, psychoanalysis is characterized by energism. Psychoanalysis, in fact, operates constantly with the concepts of instinctual energism and emotional dynamism. Drives as well as drive components work the same way as what physics call a parallelogram of forces. But on what are these forces working? The answer is the ego. The ego, in the psychoanalytic view, is ultimately a plaything of the drives. Or, as Freud himself once said, the ego is not the master in its own house. Psychological phenomena are therefore reduced to drives and instincts, and thus seem to be totally determined, i.e., caused, by them. Being human is, a priori, interpreted by psychoanalysis in terms of being driven. That is also the ultimate reason why the ego, once it has been dismembered, has to be reconstructed out of the drives. Possessed of such an atomistic, energistic, and mechanistic concept of man, psychoanalysis sees him, in the final analysis, as the automaton of a psychic apparatus. And that is precisely the point where existential analysis comes in. It pits a different concept of man against the psychoanalytic one. It is not focused on the automaton of a psychic apparatus, but rather on the autonomy of spiritual existence. Spiritual is used here without any religious connotation, of course, but rather just to indicate that we are dealing with a specifically human phenomenon, in contrast to the phenomena that we share with other animals. In other words, the spiritual is what is human in man. And thus we come back to Schnitzler's list of virtues. Just as we could apply the virtue of objectivity to psychoanalysis and that of courage to Adlerian psychology, so it is apt to apply to existential analysis the virtue of responsibility. In fact, existential analysis interprets human existence, and indeed being human, ultimately in terms of being responsible. At the time we introduced the term existential analysis in 1938, contemporary philosophy offered the word existence to denote that specific mode of being that is basically characterized by being responsible. If we were to give a quick account of what led existential analysis to recognize responsibleness as the essence of existence, then we would have to begin with an inversion of the question, what is the meaning of life? I made this inversion in my first book, Ärztliche Seelsorge, when I contended that man is not he who poses the question, what is the meaning of life, but he who is asked this question, for it is life itself that poses it to him. And man has to answer to life by answering for life. He has to respond by being responsible. In other words, the response is necessarily a response in action. While we respond to life in action, we are also responding in the here and now. What is always involved in our response is the concreteness of a person and the concreteness of the situation in which he is involved. Thus, our responsibility is always responsibility ad personam plus ad situationem. Existential analysis, in the form of logotherapy, is a psychotherapeutic method because it is concerned, in particular, with the neurotic mode of being and is intended to bring man, the neurotic in particular, to an awareness of his responsibleness. As in psychoanalysis, so in existential analysis man becomes conscious of something. But whereas in psychoanalysis it is the instinctual of which he becomes conscious, in existential analysis or logotherapy he becomes conscious of the spiritual or existential. For it is only from the viewpoint of man's spirituality or existentiality that being human can be described in terms of being responsible. What comes to consciousness in existential analysis, then, is not drive or instinct, neither id drives nor ego drives, but self. Here, it is not the ego that becomes conscious of the id, but rather the self that becomes conscious of itself. Chapter 2. The Spiritual Unconscious. We now arrive at an essential revision of the prevalent concept of the unconscious, or more specifically, of its extent. We have to expand its limits because it turns out that there is not only an instinctual unconscious, but a spiritual unconscious as well. Thus, the content of the unconscious has been differentiated into unconscious instinctuality and unconscious spirituality. Previously, we have tried to supplement psychotherapy in the strict sense of the word by introducing logotherapy as a psychotherapy centered and focusing on the spiritual, which constitutes the noological dimension as distinct from the psychological dimension. Having thus included the spiritual into psychology in general, we now include it in particular into depth psychology, that is, into the psychology of the unconscious. Freud saw only unconscious instinctuality as represented in what he called the id. To him, the unconscious was first and foremost a reservoir of repressed instinctuality. However, the spiritual may also be unconscious. Moreover, existence is essentially unconscious, because the foundation of existence cannot be fully reflected upon, and thus cannot be fully aware of itself. Since the instinctual and the spiritual are both unconscious, and the spiritual may be conscious as well as unconscious, we now have to ask ourselves how sharp these two distinctions are. The border between the conscious and the unconscious is a very fluid one. It is permeable, for there is a constant transition from one to the other. We need only consider what psychoanalysis has termed repression. In the act of repression, something conscious becomes unconscious. Vice versa, in the removal of repression, something unconscious is made conscious again. In contrast to the fluid border between the conscious and the unconscious, the line between the spiritual and the instinctual cannot be drawn sharply enough. This fact has been expressed most concisely by Ludwig Binswanger when he spoke of instincts and spirit as incommensurable concepts. Since human existence is spiritual existence, we now see that the distinction between conscious and unconscious becomes unimportant compared with another distinction. The real criterion of authentically human existence derives from discerning whether a given phenomenon is spiritual or instinctual, whereas it is relatively irrelevant whether it is conscious or unconscious. This is due to the fact that, in contrast to the psychoanalytic concept, being human is not driven but deciding what one is going to be, to quote Jaspers, entscheidendes Sein, or to quote Heidegger, Dasein. I would say that being human is being responsible, existentially responsible, responsible for one's own existence. Existence thus may well be authentic even when it is unconscious, but man exists authentically only when he is not driven, but rather responsible. Authentic existence is present where a self is deciding for itself, but not where an id is driving it. It might be said that psychoanalysis has idified and deselfified human existence. Insofar as Freud degraded the self to a mere epiphenomenon, he betrayed the self and delivered it to the id. At the same time, he denigrated the unconscious in that he saw in it only the instinctual and overlooked the spiritual. Before, we stated that the line between the spiritual, as the human in man, and the instinctual cannot be drawn sharply enough. In fact, we may conceive of it as an ontological hiatus that separates the two fundamentally distinct regions within the total structure of the human being. On one side is existence, and on the other side is whatever belongs to facticity. Whereas existence, according to our definition, is in essence spiritual, facticity contains somatic and psychic facts, the physiological as well as the psychological. And whereas the line between existence and facticity, that ontological hiatus, must be drawn as sharply as possible, within the realm of facticity the line between the somatic and the psychic cannot be drawn clearly. Any physician who has ever tried to elucidate the multidimensional etiology of a psychosomatic condition knows very well how difficult it is to differentiate between psychogenic and somatogenic components. As the dichotomy conscious-unconscious has become only a secondary issue, so the age-old psychophysical problem now proves to have lost its primary significance. It has to recede behind the much more essential problem of spiritual existence versus psychophysical facticity. This issue is not only a problem of greater ontological import, but also one of greater psychotherapeutic relevancy. After all, a psychotherapist is continually concerned with spiritual existence in terms of freedom and responsibility, and with marshaling it against the psychophysical facticity that the patient is prone to accept as his fate. The awareness of freedom and responsibleness that constitutes authentic humanness must be set against this neurotic fatalism. But we must not neglect the fact that being human is always individualized being. As such, it is always centered around a core, and this core is the person, who, in the words of Max Scheler, is not only the agent but also the center of spiritual activity. I would say that this spiritual personal center is encompassed by the peripheral psychophysical layers. Now, instead of talking of spiritual existence and psychophysical facticity, we may speak of the spiritual person and its psychophysical overlay. By its, we mean to emphasize that the person has a psychophysical overlay, whereas the person is spiritual. After all, I am not really justified in saying myself, not even myself, since I do not have a self, but I am a self. If anything, I can have an id, but precisely in the sense of psychophysical facticity. Being centered around the existential, personal, spiritual core, being human is not only individualized, but also integrated. Thus, the spiritual core, and only the spiritual core, warrants and constitutes oneness and wholeness in man. Wholeness in this context means the integration of somatic, psychic, and spiritual aspects. It is not possible to overstate that it is this threefold wholeness that makes man complete. In no way are we justified in speaking of man as only a somatic psychic whole. Body and psyche may form a unity, a psychophysical unity, but this unity does not yet represent the wholeness of man. Without the spiritual as its essential ground, this wholeness cannot exist. As long as we speak only of body and psyche, wholeness has eluded us. As far as the structure of the human being is concerned, we have so far given preference to the model of layers versus the model of strata. In fact, we have replaced the vertical hierarchy of unconscious, preconscious, and conscious strata with the model of concentric layers, a model propounded by Max Scheler. But why not go one step further by combining the strata model with the layers model? Why not conceive of the concentric layers as the ground plan of a three-dimensional structure? We would only have to imagine that the personal core, the spiritual center that is encompassed by the peripheral somatic and psychic layers, is prolonged so that we would have to conceive of it as an axis. This axis would then extend, together with the peripheral layers encompassing it, throughout the unconscious, preconscious, and conscious strata. In other words, we have put together two-dimensional models and made them into a three-dimensional one. Now the two former models have been reconciled, as it were, having become the two-dimensional projections of a three-dimensional model that more accurately depicts the human reality we are describing. Any human phenomenon, whether belonging to the personal axis or to the somatic psychic layers, may occur on any level, the unconscious, preconscious, or conscious. To take up once more the issue of depth psychology, we have to extend the meaning of this concept. Because up to now, depth psychology has followed man into the depth of his instincts, but too little into the depth of his spirit. Since depth refers to the unconscious, it necessarily follows that the person in his depth, the spirit in its depth, or for that matter, human existence in its depth, is essentially unconscious. This is due to the fact that spiritual activity so absorbs the person as the executor of spiritual acts that he is not even capable of reflecting on what he basically is. The self does not yield to total self-reflection. In this sense, human existence is basically unreflectable, and so is the self in itself. Human existence exists in action rather than reflection. Insofar as human existence cannot fully be reflected upon by itself, it cannot be fully analyzed either. That is why existential analysis can never be an analysis of existence, but only an analysis toward existence. Human existence remains an urphenomen, i.e., an unanalyzable, irreducible phenomenon. And this holds for each of its basic aspects, e.g., such human phenomena as consciousness and responsibleness. If these are to be illuminated, we have to transcend the ontic plane toward the ontological dimension. Within the plane of psychological immanence, both consciousness and responsibleness are and remain unsolvable problems. However, as soon as we transpose them into the ontological dimension, they cease to be problems, for then they are taken as urphenomena, constitutive of human existence, or in Heideggerian terms, they are existentials, attributes that belong to the very foundations of human existence. To sum up, spiritual phenomena may be unconscious or conscious. The spiritual basis of human existence, however, is ultimately unconscious. Thus, the center of the human person in his very depth is unconscious. In its origin, the human spirit is unconscious spirit. Precisely at the place of its origin, the retina of the eye has a blind spot where the optic nerve enters the eyeball. Likewise, the spirit is blind precisely at its origin. Precisely there, no self-observation, no mirroring of itself is possible. Where the spirit is original spirit, where it is fully itself, precisely there it is also unconscious of itself. We may therefore fully subscribe to what has been said in the Indian Vedas. That which does the seeing cannot be seen, that which does the hearing cannot be heard, and that which does the thinking cannot be thought. However, the spirit is unconscious not only where it originates, that is, in its depth, but also in its height. In fact, that which has to decide whether something is to be conscious or unconscious is itself unconscious. Just consider the fact that there is something in the sleeping man that decides whether or not he should continue sleeping. This guard, for example, has the sleeping mother awake as soon as the breathing of her child becomes irregular, whereas she sleeps through loud noises from the street. Even in states of hypnosis, this guard does not fail. The subject wakes up as soon as he becomes uncomfortable with the hypnotic suggestion. Only in deeper states of narcosis is this guard put to silence, put to sleep itself. Otherwise, it keeps watch over man as if it were conscious, and yet it is at best quasi-conscious. True, it somehow must know what happens around the sleeper, but this has nothing to do with actual consciousness. That which decides whether an experience will become conscious or will remain unconscious is itself unconscious. In order to make such a decision, however, it must somehow be able to discern. Since both deciding and discerning are spiritual acts, again it follows that these spiritual acts not only can be, but must be, unconscious. Unconscious and unreflectable. Chapter 3. Existential Analysis of Conscience. The phenomenon of conscience serves well as a model to further illuminate our concept of the spiritual unconscious. As we said in the preceding chapter, conscience, along with responsibleness, is a true urphenomen, an irreducible phenomenon that is inherent in the human being as a deciding being, as entscheidendes Sein. Now, whatever we have previously attempted to derive theoretically must let itself be shown phenomenologically through the medium of the phenomenon of conscience. In fact, conscience reaches down into unconscious depths and stems from an unconscious ground. It is precisely those momentous, authentic, existentially authentic, decisions that take place completely without reflection and thus unconsciously. Precisely where it originates, conscience delves down into the unconscious. In this sense, conscience is irrational. It is illogical, or better put, pre-logical. Just as there is a pre-scientific understanding, and ontologically even prior to it, a pre-logical understanding of being, so there is a pre-moral understanding of meaning, and this is conscience. The pre-moral understanding of meaning precedes any understanding of values and therefore is not contingent upon morals. In which sense may we regard conscience as being irrational? At least while in action it can never be explained in rational terms. Such explanation is possible only after the fact. Moral self-scrutiny also is possible only afterward. The judgments of conscience in the final analysis are inscrutable. If we ask ourselves why conscience necessarily operates in an irrational way, then we have to consider the following. What is disclosed to consciousness is something that is. However, what is revealed to conscience is not anything that is, but rather something that ought to be. What merely ought to be is not real, but is something to make real. It is no actuality, but mere possibility, although in a higher ethical sense, such a possibility again represents a necessity. Insofar as that which has been disclosed to conscience is still to be actualized, the question emerges how it could be realized unless it were something anticipated in the first place. Such anticipation, however, can only be enacted through intuition. So conscience is essentially intuitive. To anticipate what is not yet, but is to be made real, conscience must be based on intuition. And it is in this sense that conscience may be called irrational. But is not conscience in this respect analogous to love? Is not love just as irrational, just as intuitive? In fact, love does intuit, for it also envisions something that is not yet real. What love anticipates, however, is not an ethical necessity, but rather a personal possibility. Love reveals potentialities dormant in the loved person that he still has to make real. However, concern with mere possibilities rather than actualities is not the only common denominator of love and conscience. It is one reason why both must operate on an intuitive level. A second reason is to be seen in the fact that both love and conscience have to do with something, or someone, absolutely unique. It is the task of conscience to disclose to man the unum necesse, the one thing that is required. This one thing, however, is absolutely unique inasmuch as it is the unique possibility a concrete person has to actualize in a specific situation. What matters is the unique ought to be that cannot be comprehended by any universal law. No generally valid law in the sense of Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative can get hold of it, but only an individual law in the sense of Georg Simmel. And above all, it can never be comprehended in rational terms, but only intuitively. Insofar as conscience intuitively discloses such concrete individual possibilities of meaning, one might be tempted to think of the way conscience operates as instinctive, and thus to speak of conscience itself as an ethical instinct. But once we take a closer look, we see that this ethical instinct markedly deviates from what generally is called instinct, i.e. the biological instinct, which operates through innate releasing schemes or mechanisms, according to Conrad Lorenz. The instinctive reactions of animals to certain environmental signs and signals, Merkmale and Wirkmale, according to von Uxgall, are strictly schematic and rigid for each species. The effectiveness of such schemes thus depends on the fact that they only work for the species in general, for the benefit of the greatest number, whereas in individual cases they not only fail but sometimes even mislead the animal to act unwisely. The same instinctive pattern of reaction that preserves and saves, for example, the majority of ants, may in a given case mean the destruction of a particular ant. The wisdom of the instincts requires that such a sacrifice be made for the sake of the whole ant colony. The vital instincts, in principle, neglect the individual. The ethical instinct is entirely different. In contrast to vital instincts, the effectiveness of the ethical instinct depends on the fact that its target is not anything general, but something individual, something concrete. And just as the animal is at times misled by the vital instincts, so man may go astray, ironically, by obeying the precepts of moral reason that, as such, deal only with generalities, whereas the ethical instinct alone enables him to discover the unique requirement of a unique situation, the unum necesse. Only conscience is capable of adjusting the eternal, generally agreed upon moral law to the specific situation in which a concrete person is engaged. Living one's conscience always means living on a highly personalized level, aware of the full concreteness of each situation. Indeed, conscience has comprehended the concrete awareness, da, of my personal being, sein, all along. Love also parallels conscience with respect to the uniqueness of its target. Just as conscience aims at the uniqueness of possibilities dormant in each life situation, so love aims at the equally unique potentialities dormant in a loved person. Even more, love alone enables the loving person to grasp the uniqueness of the loved person. In this sense, love has a significant cognitive function, and certainly this was appreciated by the ancient Hebrews when they used the same word for the act of love and the act of knowledge. Are we also justified to compare the quality of deciding and choosing in love and in conscience? Does love even have to do with decision and choice? Certainly it does. To be sure, the choice of a partner is only a true choice when it is not dictated by drives. As long as, for example, an unconscious image, an imago, determines my choice, it cannot be a matter of love. And as long as a self is driven by an id to a thou, it is not a matter of love either. In love, the self is not driven by the id, but rather the self chooses the thou. However, not only love and moral conscience are rooted in the emotional and intuitive, non-rational depths of the spiritual unconscious, but also what I would call the artistic conscience. Thus, ethics and aesthetics as well have their foundation and basis within the spiritual unconscious. In fact, in his creative work, the artist is dependent on sources and resources deriving from the spiritual unconscious. The non-rational intuition of conscience is paralleled by the inspiration of the artist. Artistic creation emerges out of recesses in a realm that can never be fully illuminated. We clinicians observe time and again that excessive reflection on the creative process proves to be harmful. Forced self-observation may become a severe handicap to the creativity of the artist. An attempt to produce on a conscious level what must grow in unconscious depths, the attempt to manipulate the primal creative process by reflecting on it, is doomed to failure. Reflection comes only later. We know a case in which a violinist always tried to play as consciously as possible. From putting his violin in place on his shoulder to the most trifling technical detail, he wanted to do everything consciously, to perform in full self-reflection. This led to a complete artistic breakdown. Therapy had to start with eliminating this tendency to overbearing self-reflection and self-observation, or in the terminology of logotherapy, hyper-reflection. Therapy had to be aimed at what we call in logotherapy dereflection. Treatment had to give back to the patient his trust in the unconscious by having him realize how much more musical his unconscious was than his conscious. As a matter of fact, this treatment oriented toward the patient's reliance on his unconscious brought about the release of the artistic creative powers of his unconscious. Dereflection liberated the creative process from the inhibiting effects of any unnecessary reflection. This brings to the fore the question, what should be the goal of psychotherapy? No longer is one allowed to believe that the goal of psychotherapy consists in making something conscious at any price. Becoming conscious is no more than a transitory stage in the psychotherapeutic process. It has to make conscious the unconscious, including the spiritual unconscious, only in order to allow it finally to recede back to unconsciousness. To put it in the terms of the scholastics, what therapy has to achieve is to convert an unconscious potentia into a conscious actus, but to do so for no other reason than to restore it eventually as an unconscious habitus. It is the task of the therapist in the final analysis to reinstate the spontaneity and naivete of an unreflected existential act. This might seem to imply that artistic creativity, or any spiritual activity, is just a matter of emotions and feelings. But the concept of emotion and feeling has today become too vague, and it is important to bear in mind Scheller's distinction between feeling as a mere emotional state, Gefühlszustand, and feeling as an intentional feeling, intentionales Gefühl, i.e., a feeling directed to an intentional referent. As a matter of fact, such intentional feelings may well have their roots in the spiritual unconscious, but the mere emotional states have as little to do with spiritual existence as do any states caused by instinctual drives. To say that the concept of feeling is vague in no way implies that feeling itself is vague. At least as far as intentional feeling is concerned, it is rather the contrary. Feeling can be much more sensitive than reason can ever be sensible. The difficulties we run into when we try to explore the necessarily unconscious sources of spiritual activity are demonstrated by the fact, trivial as it might seem, that people have always made jokes and have laughed, but there is still no full scientific explication of phenomena such as joking and laughing. This shows just how independent an act can be from any reflective understanding of it. In conclusion, where the spiritual self steeps itself in its unconscious depths, there occur the phenomena of conscience, love, and art. Where it happens the other way around, however, that is to say where the somatopsychic id intrudes into consciousness, there we have to deal with a neurosis or a psychosis, depending on whether the case is psychogenic or somatogenic.
Chapter 4.
Existential Analysis of Dreams. From what has been discussed, it seems to follow that the spiritual unconscious would be extremely difficult to illuminate. And yet there is a way by which the unconscious, including its spiritual aspect, yields itself to exploration, namely by way of dreams. Since Freud introduced the classical method of dream interpretation based on free associations, we have learned to avail ourselves of this technique. This is also done in existential analysis, although our goal is to lift not only instinctual, but also spiritual phenomena into consciousness and into responsibleness. After all, dreams are the true creations of the unconscious, and therefore we may expect that not only elements of the instinctual unconscious will come to the fore, but elements of the spiritual unconscious as well. Thus we use the same method Freud did when he tracked down the instinctual unconscious, but we may use the method to a different end, the disclosure of the spiritual unconscious. Conscience has proved to be an apt model to demonstrate how the spiritual unconscious operates. The same model now may well serve us in the context of dream analysis. To take an example, a woman dreamed that, along with her dirty wash, she took a dirty cat to the laundry. When she came to pick up the laundry, she found the cat dead. She came up with the following free associations. As to cat, she said that she loved cats above all, but equally she loved her daughter, her only child, above all. From this we may infer that cat stands for child. But why is the cat dirty? That became clear as soon as we learned from the patient that recently she had been worrying about the gossip surrounding her daughter's love life. Her dirty linen, too, was being washed in public. That was the reason why the patient, as she admitted, was constantly watching and hounding her daughter. The dream therefore expressed a warning to the patient not to torment her daughter with exaggerated demands of moral cleanliness, or she might lose her child. We cannot see any reason why we should give up such a straightforward interpretation, open to whatever presents itself in the dream, in deference to the preconceived idea that behind it infantile sexual content must be hidden. The phenomena of the spiritual unconscious are empirical facts, and confronted with them, we wish to embrace the great virtue of psychoanalysis, objectivity. Such objectivity, however, should be demanded not only of the analysand, but of the analyst as well. Just as unconditional honesty is required of the analysand, so the analyst should be equally honest, and not close his eyes to the facts of the spiritual unconscious. Consider the dream of another patient. The patient reports a dream that kept recurring frequently, even within one night. He would dream that he was in another city and wanted to phone a certain lady. But the dial on the telephone was so gigantic, it contained some 100 numbers, that he never succeeded in placing the call. After waking, the patient realized that the number he meant to dial was not the lady's, but that of a record company for which he was then working with great financial success. As a matter of fact, the patient was a composer of popular music. Now, in the discussion of his dream, it turned out that he had actually spent a very satisfying time in the city he dreamed of, composing religious music, whereas his work, although outwardly successful, did not give him inner fulfillment. Except for his composing, he cherished no pleasant memories connected with that city. In particular, he had no longing for that lady with whom he had never had any erotic relationship. On the other hand, he spontaneously declared that the gigantic dial signified the trouble he had when choosing. To understand the symbolism of the dream, we have to realize that in German the same word, wählen, means choosing and dialing. What then was the patient's choice? It did not refer to a number to dial, but rather the vocation to choose. Specifically, to the choice between keeping a well-paying, unsatisfying job as a composer of hits and becoming a writer of religious music. Suddenly, the essential meaning of the dream became clear. Although in vain, the patient had been struggling to be connected again, to be reconnected. Now we have just to replace reconnexio with religio, which in Latin means the same, and it is obvious that the dream expressed the patient's desire to find his way back to his true religious and artistic vocation. This dream, unlike the previous one, does not present a warning to the dreamer, but rather expresses a self-reproach. In both cases, however, the dream is an utterance of conscience. In the second case, not only of ethical conscience, but also of the artistic conscience. And both dreams are expressions of the spiritual unconscious. In the second case, it was a religious problem that constituted the latent dream content. In the following, the same problem is encountered on a more manifest level. A patient dreamed his father handed over some saccharin to him, but he refused it with the proud remark that he would rather drink coffee or tea bitter than sweetened with some sort of sugar substitute. The free association went literally as follows. Handed over, tradition. But the tradition I got from my father is our religion. The patient continued to associate, saying that the evening before the dream he had read a magazine article recording a dialogue between an existential philosopher and a theologian. The argument of the existential philosopher seemed very plausible to him, and above all he was impressed by the philosopher's rejection of existentially inauthentic religiosity, in particular, where the philosopher refused to flee into a realm of belief and dream, and then exclaimed, "What sort of a motive is it to want to be happy? What we want is truth." So here also, in his waking life, the patient renounced inauthenticity. The same evening, the patient had heard a radio sermon that he felt somehow to be cheap consolation, and somehow sweetish. It also turned out that at one point in the magazine article, the question was asked, "What is it like when the taste for living is lost?" With that in mind, we can understand quite well why the existentially inauthentic religious tradition was associated with the realm of taste, and why the image chosen in the dream was the sugar substitute saccharin, taking the place of the genuine sweetener. This choice of symbols became fully clear when we learned that the patient's good luck piece was a religious icon, and that he disguised it from unwanted scrutiny by carrying it in a small wooden box that originally had served as a package for saccharin. In other dreams expressive of the spiritual unconscious, we meet the patient's personal problems pertaining not only to religion in general, but also to religious institutions in particular. A woman dreamed she went to the Alzer Church. To that she associated, "On the way to my psychiatrist, I pass the Alzer Church, and when I pass it, I often think, I am on the way to God. Not through the church directly, but through psychotherapy. My way to God goes, so to speak, through the doctor. On my way back from the therapy session, of course, I again pass the Alzer Church, and so going to therapy is only a detour to the church." The dream itself continues as follows. The church seems to be deserted. That the church is deserted signifies that the patient has deserted the church. In fact, she had turned her back on the church. The dream continues. The church is entirely bombed out. The roof has fallen in, and only the altar remains intact. The inner shock the patient experienced from the war has shaken her spiritually, but has also opened her eyes to the central place, the altar of religion in life. The blue heavens shone through here. The air is free. Interpretation: those inner shocks have freed her eyes to see the celestial. But above me is still the remainder of the roof, beams that threaten to fall down, and I am afraid of that. Interpretation: the patient is afraid of falling back and of once more being buried in debris. And I flee into the open, somewhat disappointed. Interpretation: the patient actually had recently gone through disappointments not only with her own affirmation of religion, but also with religious institutions. Complete affirmation of her religion had been hampered by occasional impressions of pettiness and narrowness on the part of some priests and theologians. It was not surprising that the patient had troubles with institutionalized religion, for she said she had experienced ecstatic mystical states several times. Therefore, it was interesting to explore this side of her religious problems and to see how far this aspect of the patient's spiritual unconscious found expression in her dreams. I find myself on St. Stephen's Square. This is the center of Catholic Vienna. I stand in front of the main door of St. Stephen's Cathedral, and I see that it is closed. Interpretation: she has no access to Christianity. In the cathedral it is dark, but I know God is there. To this the patient produces as a spontaneous association the following quotation from the Psalms: "Truly you are a hidden God." The dream continued, "I am searching for the entrance." interpretation, she is searching for an entrance to Christianity. It is almost 12 noon. Interpretation, it is high time. Father N.N. is preaching inside. Father N.N. was for this patient somehow representative of Christianity. Through a small window I can see his head. Interpretation, what he represents goes beyond the small part she sees of him. I want to get inside. Interpretation, she wants to turn away from his appearance and turn toward the essence. I am running through narrow passages. The connection between narrowness, anger, and anxiety, angst, is well known. The patient, indeed, is anxiously and impatiently striving to reach her goal. I have a box of candy with me, with the inscription on it, God Calls. Interpretation, she is called to a religious life, which is the goal toward which she is so impatiently striving, and the way to this goal already contains the sweetness of ecstatic mystical experiences. I take a candy out of the box and eat it, although I know that it may make me sick. The patient had repeatedly reported that she deliberately exposed herself to the risk of insanity as a potential result of her mystic states, i.e. the risk that they might make her sick. I'm afraid someone may see the inscription on the candy box. I'm ashamed and start to erase the inscription. The patient knew that her case was going to be published, and so tried everything she could to thwart its publication. Here we are confronted with a fact that will come to be quite important, namely, that people are sometimes ashamed of their religiousness and try to conceal it. The mistake is often made of confounding such shame with neurotic inhibition. Shame, however, is a perfectly natural attitude. Since Max Scheler's work on this subject, we know that shame has a distinctive protective function in love. Its task is to prevent something from becoming a mere object, an object for onlookers. So we could say the cause of love is served by not being observed. Love flees publicness, for man is afraid that what is sacred to him might be profaned by becoming public. More specifically, this profanation might occur through a loss of immediacy in giving oneself to and loving the other. Such immediacy, however, is threatened not only by becoming an object for others, but by becoming an object for one's own self-observation as well. In both cases, the immediate original genuineness of love is liable to vanish. Its existentiality is liable to dwindle into mere facticity. Being is turned into being observed, be it by oneself, be it by others. Loving is in danger of being de-selfified and idified. Now, something analogous may happen to religiousness. The quality of intimacy so characteristic of love is no less characteristic of religion. It is intimate in two senses. It is intimum, in the sense of innermost, and second, it is, like love, protected by shame. Genuine religiousness, for the sake of its own genuineness, hides from the public. That is why religious patients often do not want to deliver their intimate experiences into the hands of people who would perhaps lack understanding and thus misinterpret them. Such patients may be afraid that a psychiatrist will try to unmask their religiousness as nothing but the manifestation of unconscious psychodynamics, of conflicts or complexes. Or they may fear just as much that their religiousness will be interpreted as something impersonal, be it in the sense of unconscious archetypes or of the collective unconscious. One can understand why the patient shied away from seeing herself one day published as a case, and her religious feelings thereby somehow debased into the mere object of a detached scientific investigation. Of course, patients are reluctant not only to become cases in publications, but also to be demonstrated before a public, such as being part of clinical demonstrations of psychotherapy to medical students. In the classroom setting, we could witness time and again that patients who are quite ready to talk about their sexual lives in the most intimate and even perverse details are the same ones who display marked inhibitions as soon as the discussion turns to their intimate religious life. For example, during one of these demonstrations, a patient happened to be asked if she could reproduce a dream, and she came up with the following one. "I am in the middle of a great crowd of people. It is like a fair. Everyone is moving in one direction while I myself try to go in the opposite direction. Interpretation, in the fair that this world is, the great masses of people are all alike. The patient, however, is swimming against the current. Somehow I know the direction in which I have to go, for from the heavens shines a light which I am going toward. This light gets brighter and brighter, and finally condenses into a figure. Interpretation. At first the patient knew the direction only approximately, but now she knows it more precisely. Then we asked what sort of a figure it was. With that, however, the patient became embarrassed, and after much hesitation she asked with an imploring look, "Do I really have to talk about that?" Only after much persuasion did she let out her secret and murmur, "The figure was Christ." In her dream, her conscience had demanded that she follow Christ. In this dream there is scarcely any religious problem left, since to this patient it was unquestionable that she had to take the religious path. In contrast, the dreams reported before this one showed clear-cut religious problems, be they manifest or latent, depending on whether the religiousness was conscious to the patient or had been repressed by him into the unconscious. That repression of religiousness can occur is no longer a surprise when we realize the intimate quality inherent in genuine religiousness. Nor is it surprising occasionally to find flagrantly religious motifs in dreams of people who are manifestly irreligious, because we have seen that there is not only repressed and unconscious libido, but also repressed and unconscious religio. One of my patients once spontaneously declared, "How come I am ashamed of whatever is religious, that it seems to me bothersome and ridiculous?" Well, I know very well myself why I feel so ashamed about my religious longings. Underlying all the psychotherapeutic treatment I've had these last 27 years was the more or less tacit conviction on the part of my doctors that such longings are nothing but unrealistic, baseless speculation. As they put it, only the tangible is real and everything else is nonsense, caused by a trauma or by the wish to escape life by fleeing into disease. So whenever I expressed my longing for God, I was almost afraid they would bring in the straitjacket. Until now, every type of psychotherapy missed the point. A patient of mine wanted to discover why she had such a dislike for Christianity. She had not practiced her religion since childhood. In a deliberate combination of logotherapy and suggestive measures, I gave her the post-hypnotic suggestion, "Tonight I shall receive the answer from my dreams." This is the dream that she reported the next day. "I am in the town where I spent my childhood. I am waiting for a train to Vienna." The patient thereby sums up her way from the past into the present. "Dr. X lives there. I want to visit him." Dr. X is a well-known psychotherapist and a good friend of the patient's family. Thus the dream indicates a need for psychotherapy. "I don't know what Dr. X's address is. I ask a woman and she says, 'Near the church.'" The patient knows that her recovery and psychotherapy can only be completed through religion. "I am thinking in the dream, eventually I shall find the church again." So she is optimistic. Needless to say, the church here means more than just the building. Thus the dream indicates her hope and conviction that she will find her way back to religion. But everything is so different from what it used to be. To find this way back is not so simple for an adult who has been chased through the hell of life and of doubt. I wonder which street to take. Which way should she take to come back to religion? I have been walking a long time. I feel doubtful. In the dream, this doubt refers to the way to Dr. X, but in reality, it is doubt about God. A little girl is standing in front of me and gives me information. Spontaneously, the patient observed that this girl represented herself as she was in her childhood. So I asked her whether she knew the biblical saying, "You must become like children again," and the patient told me that this passage had always impressed her deeply. And what was the information this girl handed out in the dream? "Near the church, but you have taken the wrong way. You must go back." So the patient feels that first she must go back to the simplicity of children, as this characterizes their faith. "I am thirsty." To this the patient associates a verse from the Psalms. "As the hart panteth after the water brooks, so panteth my soul after thee." The dream continues. "The child draws clear water from a spring, and now I am actually going back." The way back means psychotherapy, more specifically, existential analysis. Suddenly, I see poplars lying across the street. These fallen poplars signify the difficulties and relapses that had emerged during therapy. But then the way is clear again, and in the distance is the church, a miraculous cathedral, milky white like the one in Caen. In her own attempt to interpret the dream, it came out that when driving to France on a trip some years before, she had looked forward to seeing the cathedral because she had known it from pictures and admired it very much. But when her party arrived in Caen, it was so dark and so foggy that she never actually saw the cathedral. We feel justified in interpreting the transformation of the cathedral, which she had never seen but had so much longed for, into the splendorous sight of the church in the dream, as a symbol of the transformation of the patient's concept of God that had taken place through treatment, namely the transition from the Deus absconditus into the Deus revelatus.